I mean, I read your biography and all that, and I only have read this one short story that you sent us and that will be published at the beginning of the Frankfurt Book Fair, which is really,
Oh,
really nice.
fun,
I'm looking
fun.
forward to it. And I just read that you started writing when your father died and all. I mean, you became interested in literature, but your family background must be you are from an educated middle-class family, isn't it? Otherwise, you wouldn't have thought of starting writing.
Yeah, actually, my mother comes from a political family and from Cebu. And so you could say we were upper middle class, but to temper that, I was born right after the war, and you know how a war devastated places. It's everybody's sort of the same. Everybody's struggling. So my parents, even though my father was a professor at the University of Philippines before the war. My mother was on the way to being a classical pianist also in Manila, but when war broke out, they had to go to Mindanao. They evacuated to Mindanao, and when the war ended, Manila was devastated. It was as badly destroyed, perhaps, as Warsaw. It was just really bad. And so my father decided that they would live in the south, in Cebu, where my mother's family was there to more or less, help. By this time, he had three kids. So that's where they settled, and that's where I was born. So that's the kind of like beginning. So my father was a professor in engineering, but he was a man who played a violin, who read a lot, who brought his children to bookstores every Friday or Saturday. And so even as a little child, I grew up looking at comics or Nancy Drew and all of these books, So it was part of my life. And at that time, a long time ago, Axel, we did not have, even then, we didn't have television. That came in like when in the 50s. So that was our entertainment and playing outside. And it was my sister who got me started in writing a journal. It was just a gift. It was one of those lock and key diaries. So I started writing in there, little poetry that's not really very terrific. And just as an aside, actually, I sent those diaries to the Ateneo. They have started papers for some writers. So I just sent those and some of my other academic papers, letters from writers and so on and so forth. And so that I sort of the reading and the writing went together. And this was in the beginning, it was a way of writing letters to my father, update him on my life, writing in this little journal that was kind of just a little girl, poetry and so on. And just falling in love with story, the notion of story. So that was the beginning. And I went to school that was run by Belgian nuns. And I don't know anything, if you know anything about Belgian Catholic nuns, but they're very strict. I mean, it's a very disciplined. And so we were very we were in a disciplined environment, but they really encouraged academics. And so aside from the usual sciences that we read, we had a little bit of music, we always had theme writing. We had theatrical productions. And so again, that notion of story was in there. But a lot of it was I think this little girl's sadness of the loss of her father. And the house became chaotic, My mother was this once upon a time beauty queen who was a spoiled politician's daughter, suddenly a widow with four kids. And so the house was just chaotic, and she was trying to hold it together and all of this stuff. So that was a refuge. School was a refuge. It gave me the structure, and writing was it was like my friend. I could talk to this journal. And then it just sort of started morphing. You know, once you get the love words,
Yeah.
then you're doing the letters, and then suddenly you're doing little poems, and suddenly you're doing other things. It sits in your head.
Yeah. And when did it become a professional idea? I mean, did you?
That's a good question, because actually, the idea that I would really become a writer, even though I was writing for fun, because first I wanted to be a filmmaker. Again, the notion of storytelling. And so from the Philippines, from Maryknoll College, I actually came to California to study filmmaking at UCLA. But
Oh,
as
really? That
yes,
was the reason you moved to the US.
yes, for as a student, as a graduate student. And but I got married. And at that time, it was really very, the film industry here was very closed, and it was not easy to like break into it. Further, it's a very expensive medium, and it was just something that it was so, I sort of started writing stories that were running around in my head, and I liked that I could just. It was me and the typewriter. It was a typewriter then. It was not dealing with, just in the film productions of school, you needed to deal with a team. It was, big cameras and all of this. And the other frustrating thing I discovered with filmmaking was you could have an idea in your head, but by the time everybody else had input, it was different. I would be surprised with my film productions. It was like not exactly what was in my head. But whereas with the writing, since it was me and the typewriter, I had better control of it. And so it was more satisfying. It was difficult. I was writing stories and they were starting to get published, but even I knew, and this was already when I had my third son. What happened was we were starting as a family, and I had to work, and so there was really no time for writing. But then when the second child came along, it was decided that I would stay at home to take care of the kids. But it turned out I had a little bit of time. So then I started writing these stories. And I started submitting them, and they were getting published in the Philippines. But I knew that they were not the best I could make them. And so I started taking classes over at UCLA at the writer's program, where amazingly you actually pick up skills. You get rid of cliches, you learn. I improved my skills, and I learned the business. And so that's just sort of how it grew. And there were some kind writers along the way, as there are, who introduced me to this publisher, who encouraged me. Ben Santos, Bienvenido N. Santos, for one. I mentioned them because they've been so kind to me. Lina Espinamor, Frankie Jose, who passed away a couple of years ago. And they were the ones, Linda T. Casper, whom I have now published, but they were the ones who pretty much when I was starting out said, go for it, you can do it. And so bit by bit, but it's not easy.
No, it's not easy at all. And what I really wonder is, I mean, being part of the diaspora, I mean, if you look at authors like Thomas Mann or J.M. Coetzee, who moved to Australia, I
Yes.
mean, their writing has always changed significantly when they moved to other places. I mean, the whole writing style, the content, the topics changed a lot. So I wonder, I mean, how.
Interesting.
I mean, you've stayed so long in the US. I mean, would you call yourself still a Filipino writer, or would you say you are more or less an American writer that has Filipino topics as well on the on the on your desk?
I use two hats. I call myself a Filipino writer, and I call myself a Filipino American writer. Caveat, Even though I live in California, I reside in California, I have actually been visiting before the pandemic twice a year. And then when the pandemic happened, not. And then now once a year. So I am quite in touch with the culture. And further, it is that culture that I am most interested in. Even though I have stories that one would call our PhilAm, Philippine American, it is the stories from Cebu, Ubek. I have called it Ubek, I have reversed it, that fascinate me. I know they're just imagination, but it's that setting and the people who live there. I look at my family members. My last novel, the third one, was based on my great grandmother. She was just a model. It's not really her, but she ended up being the first woman publisher in the Philippines. And so the title of my novel is The Newspaper Widow. And so it's this newspaper widow and her friend who solve a crime. It's a literary mystery. So it is that I look at most of all. And I think if there's any kind of contribution that I have done, it would be primarily to Philippine lit, to Philippine literature. And most certainly, I believe they have embraced me. I mean, the Ateneo just invited to have my papers, and they called it a repatriation of my things, bringing it back home.
Yeah, what I find interesting is that if I look to draw this back to history, if I see Thomas Mann back in California during the Second World War, his being away so far of Germany changed his complete attitude towards politics in Germany and Europe, towards what is German, what it could have been, what is happening now, and it really changed his whole mindset. And I wonder, with you being so far away, although visiting like Thomas Mann, of course he came back after the Second World War, and it is but the change remained with him. So what about you? I mean, there's so many virile problems in the Philippines. I mean,
I think a big difference, maybe, Axel, that during Thomas Mann's time, there was the communication was not as swift. I mean, right now, I am like, I know what's going on in the Philippines if I want to, or anywhere in the world, just kind of go in there. But then, of course, now we have fake news, but they had fake news also, so you have to use your head. So I think that there's probably more information available now for me than Thomas Mann did. Now, I am not saying, I will say this, if I had stayed in the Philippines, I think that I would be a different writer. And here's the thing, frankly, because I am far away and I kind of have an objective eye, I'm looking at things from afar. In a way, it empowers me. If I were there as a writer, I think I would be very conscious of what I write. I may hurt feelings. I have a little story. I have a writer friend, a friend who was wanting to be a writer. And she would agonize over words because she was writing in English, but then she wanted it to sound Tagalog. And what will she call dried fish? Will she call it dried fish or will she call it tinapa? She was agonizing over these things that I've already let go. I've already made decisions about the language. And finally, I.
Can I interrupt you here? Because I find this very interesting. I mean, did you ever thought of writing in Tagalog or in Filipino instead of English? Or was this the chosen language from the beginning for you?
Okay, here's the thing. I actually was raised and taught English grammar and not taught the Cebuano grammar. So while I can speak Cebuano, I don't think I can write elegantly in Cebuano. I can read, even reading very deep Cebuano, I kind of have a hard time. So, I mean, it's a little bit embarrassing, but that's just how it is. And I'm not the only one. When you're used to just reading English and English or whatever language it is, that's the language that you master for the writing then, you know. So that's what it is. So it's a funny kind of thing because even there are other Filipinos writing in English whose work has to be translated into Tagalog or whatever language. So the other thing, because I had a Cebuana writer friend tell me, Cecilia, just write like you talk. It really isn't. You don't just write like you talk, you know. There was a kind of a calculation in a sense early on in my writing. If I write in Cebuano, not that I really could do it elegantly, the readership is very narrow. Also, I don't, the publishing houses, how many publishing houses are there that will publish you in Cebuano to a limited market? You're like almost killing yourself as a writer. My idea was to tell a story to as many people as I could in the best way I could. And this was the best way that I could. So there was some reasoning and thinking behind that.
Yes, I think so. And this is the idea I got when I, with all the talks I had with writers, that there is, I mean, the country is divided in so many ways, and language is one of these
Exactly.
divisions that make it very difficult for people with minority languages, of course, to write in their language, as you said, because no publishing houses, no readers, and that is of course a pity that the. What I mean, after this is just my perspective, that the big project of the national language of Filipino
Yeah.
hasn't been as successful as in Indonesia with Bahasa or in Tanzania with Kiswahili, where they managed within 50 years to build up the language as an identity marker as well.
Yes. Well, I think a lot of it probably has to do with the economics, Axel. I mean,
Yes.
publishing houses will publish what will sell ultimately. And now there are more Filipino as in Tagalog, books out there, and there are some translations. But yes, so their challenges are great because they have to sell the books. And so, how many
Yes.
buyers do you have? If they get grants, it helps.
Yes, and some authors like Ronaldo Vivo, I've met him as well in Manila. He said, of course, with his books written in Filipino, very rough books, with his trilogy, I mean, he was very successful, selling over 100,000 books. And but even then, still with this amount of selling books, he can't live off that. Of course, it is
No.
living from literature is, I think, impossible anywhere in the world.
Exactly.
Only if you write maybe bestsellers or, but this is, yeah, even that has changed. A bestseller nowadays is called a bestseller in Germany when it sells more than 10,000 copies, and of 10,000 copies, you
Yes.
can't live.
Yeah. No, I think I read statistics that only 10% of writers actually make some kind of money. So most of them teach and write. Do something else and write. So that's it. Basically, we're doing it because we love it. To me, anyway, it's not. Now there are some, I have to say, there are some writers who make the decision to write commercial stories. And good luck to them. You know, sometimes they succeed and most of the time not, because it's just hard to calculate what exactly will sell. So
Of course, and then to cross maybe the border out of the Filipino diaspora community to even maybe the American reader, for example. And but this is my next question. I wonder, I mean, there are a couple of, for example, Vietnamese writers like
yeah.
Ocean Vuong, who managed, of course, to draw a picture about their deconstructed identity, about the difficulties of the second generation. of migrants, and this topic is of course a topic that is not only interesting for the diaspora. It is, I mean, it's interesting for anybody because in these days everybody
Yes,
is almost a
yes.
migrant, and so facing this topic of how difficult it is to shape your identity, not in the homeland but abroad, is crossing borders and therefore selling even books to non-Vietnamese
Yes,
readers in the
yes.
States or even in Germany. And
Well,
is it the same with the Filipino diaspora writers? I mean, are they shaping this topic as well?
we have Filipino slash American writers, however you call them, who have been very successful and have been published by big houses. Gina Apostol is one of them. There are very many now, more than before, frankly. Young adult writers, Randy Ribay. So that's going on. It remains a difficult market, really, because when these big publishing houses publish you, it's not because they like you, it's really because of the money. It's the money. Exactly. You know how
Yes.
much they can love your work, but if it does not translate into sales, they're not going to take it on. So that's one thing going on. The other thing is, and you know this, really to reach the big houses, you need an agent. And even finding a literary agent in itself is difficult. Now, I had a literary agent for my first novel, and that was published by Dot and Penguin, and that was a big house. It did not sell enough, and in like 3 years, it was remaindered. And that's the nature of it. Miguel Cijuco's book and The Mango Bride, Marivy Solivin, same story. They made big houses, and then in 3 years or whatever, they just kind of they remainder it. They kill it. So this was another calculation on my part as a writer. I have discovered that small presses do not kill your work. They have already invested in it, and they're not really out there for the big bucks, and they will just keep it going. They will just keep your and I decided, because I had a really traumatic experience when my first novel by this big Dot and Penguin was suddenly dropped. I was dropped along with Vincent van Gogh, by the way. Some accountant sat down and said, these books did not make money. So I was right there with Van Gogh. I went, all right, I'm in good
Really?
company. Yeah. So that's how it happens. And so I have seen it. I have seen these big names, are big, and then their books are no longer there in 2, 3 years. And I find them scrambling to find another publisher, and some of them want to regain that big glory of, a big commercial press and having a really difficult time. And these are calculations that I have gone through, and so I believe some writers have gone through as well. Because it's not easy to have your work be of it. Oh, the other thing too, Axel, is that it can actually mess you up in a sense of your availability, the availability of your work in the Philippines. Example. Now, this was a while ago, but Wilfredo Noledo, a fine writer who's no longer with us, he's passed on, was in the United States as a Iowa writer, student, whatever it was, and he came up with one two novels that were picked up by big houses. I forget if it was Random House or whatever it was. Well, the problem then that happened with Wilfredo was his books were not available in the Philippines, not easily accessible. So to truncate the story, it was in a way as if he was forgotten. In a way, it was a, and you know what I mean? So, in fact, Mara Kosson, I don't know if you have met her, she started Exploding Galaxies. Her mission is to bring back these so-called forgotten classics. And so she took on Wilfredo Nolledo's one novel anyway and brought it back because it was basically forgotten by the ordinary people. The academics knew about it because they could afford to order from the States or whatever it was, but the ordinary people in the Philippines could not access it. So it's a funny little thing, you know? So you kind of go, so whom do I want to make sure I'm read in Cebu, where I come from, because I feel these are their stories. That's another part of the calculation that I have put in. So there's a lot of decisions that sort of people make without really consciously perhaps doing them, you know? And some people just want, I want to make the money, I want to be famous, I want to be this and that. And they can go for it, and sometimes they're successful. But as I said, most of the time your work is going to be remaindered. I mean, it happened to Ninochka Roska. Her famous novels, The Martial Law and so on, they were eventually remaindered, but they were picked up. They were picked up. Now, my Rainbow Goddess was remaindered by Dot and Penguin. It was picked up by University of Michigan Press, which has kept it alive, and they will keep it alive until doomsday, you know?
Yeah, and what I always think it's always a danger, of course, to please the big houses with your topics, because
Exactly.
when you're once successful with one topic, you are in a trap.
Exactly.
You have to deliver. I mean, this topic again and again, because they know this is successful. This is what they think people want to read. So you are like, if I want to go back to Ocean Vuong, I mean, you always write on your broken identity and about your diversity or sexual
Exactly.
and
Exactly.
differences. I mean, and this is, of course, I mean, you are in a big trap then, and you don't have the freedom anymore to decide what you want to write on.
You they sort of peg you because that is what the commercial, what will sell. So, and it's kind of, and that's when the shaping of you happens because they will actually suggest to you. So when I had the Rainbow Goddess, it was suggested to me to write a sequel, you know, by Dot and Penguin. Well, I'm not into sequels. So, you know what I mean? But if I were, all right, I will just make, you know, Rainbow Goddess 2 or whatever it was. So they do kind of, and then the problem there then is because I had a writer friend who he had two bestsellers and it went along those lines. He had a murder mystery and then they wanted another one and then every time it came out, the readership went down because it was getting boring. If the first time it was honest, it came from him, and the second one was just like pulp, and then they just got rid of him. And in a sense, he sort of lost his voice in an odd kind of way because he had tied himself to that topic, you know. So it was a little sad. He never again, I think he had three books and he never wrote again. It was very sad, I thought. But yeah. So, I mean, this whole industry thing can kind of mess with your head as a writer, I find. So you have to, in a way, you have to be hard-headed and you have to sort of know what you want and what are you doing? Are you doing this for fame? Are you doing this for what? So for me, it's because the stories run around in my head and the stories are coming from my people and I feel they need to hear it. They need to access it because it's telling them.
And if you come back to your stories, I mean, would you say that political issues in the country, in the Philippines, are a strong part of your stories? Are they influencing your stories a lot? I mean, the time of Duterte, for example, which has influenced a lot of local authors to
Yeah.
write quite harsh and gruesome stories, I would say.
I think politics is really in there. Now, I don't have a lot of Duterte stories, but I do have Marcos stories. But they're not about Marcos per se. It's about
Of
the
course.
characters during that time whose lives have been affected by this tension going on. And it's the same thing with the World War II novel. Then it's these people trying to survive under this cloud of a war. So that's sort of how I operate.
And And if you say your stories are about this Marcos time, martial law, and all that, I mean, in the background,
The background.
I mean, what are you? I mean, when you learn to know that his son came to power, I mean, isn't it somehow ironic? I mean,
It's
it's. I mean, what were you thinking when? Because you were, of course, into this time, you were writing about it. I mean, what did you?
it is crazy making, Axel. And what is even crazier making is when the son sort of steps in and tries to save us from Duterte. You know, he's the one who caused the man to end up in The Hague. So we're all going, whoa, you know, this is so you then that's when you go, oh, that's the Philippines. I mean, this man's mother is still around. She was, you
I know.
know, so
Yeah.
it's no, it's and it makes you realize really that there's a lot that needs to be fixed in the Philippines because we still have political dynasties.
Yes.
Marcos family, the Macapagals, even though Duterte daughter is right there, just on and on. And then, I mean, okay, so you have the intellectuals and the educated people who go never again, never again. And yet you have a large population still going for whatever.
I mean, a
Seems.
young author in Miller told me, I mean, the last communal elections were a little bit of hope because the first time one of these big family dynasty members were voted out, and they say maybe it's a generation that is bringing a change to the system. I don't know. I mean, I've talked to others who have not the hope that changes are going to come. I mean, do you have a vision, something? Maybe a positive vision or a negative vision for the future of the Philippines?
There's a lot that needs to be addressed. Even the population itself is so huge. It's
Yeah.
just, you know, I mean, simple things like that. And yet we believe everything that the Catholic Church tells us, which is to multiply because the church. So there's a lot of educating that needs to be done. They had a big rally out there about corruption because government
Yeah,
officials,
I saw the
you know
pictures there.
about that. Axel, I live in a place where people throw garbage into creeks and rivers. So now they're complaining because it's a real danger, but that's been happening for decades. Again, education. A long time ago, people should have been educated to respect our rivers, our creeks, so that the water flows out and our fishes are not dirty or polluted, you know? So, yes, to me, education is still really very important. And I think then, see, the people you talk with are intelligentsias. They're the ones with education. And so they're going to be talking another way than the ones without education. And they just fall for whatever is thrown them in social media or fake news. Again, another thing that you have to educate people not to believe everything that is told you or that you see, especially now with.
Almost impossible. I think it wasn't possible in the Third Reich in the 1930s in Germany. I mean, fake
Exactly.
news were out there without all this machinery we have today. So it's hard to educate people in the way that to avoid this dilemma.
Yeah, well, that's why it's scary. Well, and
Yeah.
I'm talking, I'm coming from the United States. I'm not going to get into it, but we have our issues. Very, very kind of serious, especially because it is a powerful country that is already wreaking havoc all over. So, you know.
Just a short glimpse on that. I mean, is the Filipino community in the US fearing that something could happen to them as well? I mean, is the fear there?
I think some are afraid now, but Filipinos are very interesting people. Do you know that quite enough of them voted for him? Filipino Americans voted for you know who so that he's president? enough of them. For some bizarre reason, it seems trendy for them to identify with the kind of WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Morris. And I don't get it. And many times they vote against their own self-interests for little things. You know, they vote against their interests, and we're all going, why are you doing that? And so now some of them are feeling the repercussions because their relatives cannot just come in easily, will now have to pay a lot to come and visit them. But I'm not really, what has happened is some of them, the ones who voted for him, have just kept quiet. I don't really hear like, oh, mea culpa. No, they're just like, they've just gone quiet, you know. So, but I'm sure there's a certain percentage in there that has realized the damage that they have done. But we're looking at what happened in Germany, the way I look at it.
Exactly. It's everywhere. More or less the same, but I think the reasons behind it are different. For me, this kind of risky freedom. I mean that for many, especially young people, it is just over demanding to decide on everything in your life. It has become
Yes.
a burden. I mean, freedom has become a burden, and this burden, of course, I mean, if you are there, I mean, if you are to blame for everything, you even fail. You're not
Yeah.
part of a party anymore, of a group or whatever. You are just the individual who is responsible
Yes.
for yourself. And to give this up again, this responsibility to some so-called strong person, is tempting.
Yes. No. Again, this influence of social media is just terrific. You know, I mean, it's just, and it makes you crazy. I mean, sometimes I look in social media and I'm thinking, oh, how wonderful, because Colbert was fired, you know, about to find a job in Netflix. And I check it and it's fake news. And so I think all of that is just to make us sort of doubt what is right, what is correct, and what isn't.
I agree.
It affects you. And I will tell you, even AI will make me a little crazy, because I have a friend who had a picture in the forest. She wasn't in the forest. That was AI. And I'm going, that's kind of creepy. It's making me crazy. You know? It's
I mean, it's really interesting. We are in a time of transformation like I think never before, and this is on all levels, and that is exciting, interesting, but frightening as well. It is because you can't say what is going to happen tomorrow. I think these intervals of big changes are becoming shorter and shorter, and this makes things very hard to understand and to align with.
Yeah. Well, and then I think, in addition to what you said, we have become lazy. A lot of us have become lazy to think. You said about how young people, it's easier to just fork it over to a strong man. Well, a lot of people have given up just sort of like critical thinking. It's like it's easier to hand it on to somebody, or to just believe, or to just follow sheer emotions. And you and I know that if you follow sheer emotions, that's not always the correct thing.
That's right. And because it is so difficult to interact with a different opinion, you stay in your social bubble
Yes.
that enforces your thinking even more. And
Exactly. It's like an echo chamber.
exactly.
Yeah,
Very,
yeah.
yeah, that's how it is. Yeah, but in the end, it produces a lot of interesting literature. I mean, that is all this crisis is after another, one battle after another. I mean, this is, of course, very good for any art, for literature, for films.
Very good. It actually stimulates the artists. Oh,
Exactly.
very good. I never really saw that bright side. I tend to see the negative, but that's a good thing to
Yeah,
look.
I mean, I was seeing that. I mean, I was observing this in South Africa after apartheid. I thought, wow, this country is now completely gone. It is now really difficult. But with these absolute amazing transition to another society. It produced literature in a way
Ah.
that I have never ever thought of. I mean, so many great, fantastic authors has come out of that. And I
Huh.
think, and this is a chance of a country like the Philippines as well, with all these crises, with, I mean, it's not only politics, it is, of course, the nature, changing of climate, it is the diversity of everything. And this, of course, is a big chance, I think, for amazing literature that just needs to be heard in the world, I think.
I know, but Axel, what I am seeing is a desire to be commercial, and it's a lot of comics and a lot of, romance and a lot of this kind of stuff. And there are just very few serious writers who are tackling these topics, but they are there. So serious writers, and they are quite diligent with their work. One of them is in Cebu, Resil Mojares. He's a national artist, and he's a very serious academe and a writer. So when I know about people like that, I feel heartened. We do our best, and I know that sometimes people are doing their best, but when I see that the product is just romance or And I'm not knocking romance or comic books, but it's just that we have more important things to worry about, to look at. I just sort of sigh a little bit, but whatever. Again, I have to remind myself that each writer is just doing his or her best.